Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's the Friday News Roundup, where we check in with area journalists to talk about stories making this week's headlines. Massachusetts health officials started treating alpha-gal, the allergen to mammal products passed on by Lone Star ticks, as a reportable disease beginning this spring. While the vineyard has been a hot spot for the syndrome, the new reporting shows that the Cape has started to see cases as well. CAI Sam Houghton joins us. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Mindy.
So the state started requiring doctors to report positive tests of alpha-gal starting April 1st. So how many cases has the Cape seen so far?
Yeah, so far 16 cases of alpha-gal reported on the Cape. Important to say that some of those were actually cases confirmed a few years ago and just now have been kind of added to this tracker system, though most of them were recently reported, and not surprising here, but most of them were actually on the Upper Cape. So 16, not a massive number, but something to be aware of. And I spoke with a disease tracker for the Cape, Stephanie Barth. She works with Cape Cod Healthcare and the VNA. She actually just started on the Cape after helping to track alpha-gal and Lone Star ticks on the vineyard, where I think most of our listeners probably know alpha-gal has just kind of blown up over the last few years. And while this is just a handful of cases on the Cape, Barth said that the prevailing wisdom here is that we're seeing what we're seeing on the vineyard that might not be that far away on the Cape. She actually told me that within 5 or 10 years, alpha-gal will be common here like it is on the vineyard, which is troubling, maybe. I don't know. And I learned with my conversation with the local specialist that they actually think seabirds carried the ticks to the Cape. And actually, that's how they arrived on the vineyard, too. So Lone Star ticks known to be in the south, but they've been making their way north and have really taken a hold on the vineyard.
Yeah. Now, you reported on the vineyard for the last several years. Give us a sense of how widespread alpha-gal is on the island. You'll remind us what's happening.
Yeah. So within the last 4 or 5 years, the syndrome's really risen pretty dramatically. I believe there were 2 positive cases reported in 2020. And last year, there were about 500 that year. And I think part of that may be public awareness is growing around alpha-gal. So more people are getting tested. But already this summer, the hospital recently reported there had been 200 alpha-gal cases on the vineyard, and we're only in June. Some interesting points to make here. The vineyard really is ahead of the game in kind of getting its arms around this, partly because the tick population really has boomed there. But before the state started treating alpha-gal as a reportable disease this spring, the Vineyard Hospital had been doing that for the public for years. And in my conversation with local specialists, you know, education is really important. By reporting the number of cases of alpha-gal, in a way, it's letting the public know that, hey, this is an issue and you may want to pay attention. And she's hoping to raise that awareness here in the Cape, that Lone Star ticks are here. They're a hardy tick. It will likely boom in population the way they've seen on the vineyard. And you should be aware of the symptoms that come along with alpha-gal.
Yeah, and not every tick carries it. That's the other thing. Do you think you get bit, you're going to automatically have it, but that's not necessarily the case. All right, so tell us what we should know about this. A popular belief is that this is an allergy to red meat, but it's really not quite that simple, right?
Right. It is red meat, but it's also mammal products. So hamburgers, dairy, pork. But then you really think about it, you think of gels. The capsules on many medications are made from mammal products. So that could be an issue for someone. Butter is pretty much in everything. Not just cheeseburgers. And one thing, you know, researchers are really looking to get a handle on, some people have more severe symptoms than others, and they're trying to find out why. Some people in the vineyard now carry EpiPens because they're worried about going into shock. Some might have really mild reactions, others just indigestion, headaches, and things like that. And the other thing is here, the allergy can take up to 10 hours to kick in. So it's really difficult to know that it might be coming from alpha-gal. And, you know, I can editorialize here. It's kind of depressing thing here is prevention is really the only thing you can do. There are no treatments, no cures or anything. I guess the syndrome, the kind of through line here is it does, Barth's message was, we just have to kind of learn how to live with this, at least for now. And it does wear off over time, we should say that. But anecdotally, you know, this is pure anecdote, but I live in Falmouth and saw one Lone Star tick all of last year. I've already seen 4 or 5 just in my backyard. Yeah.
Seems like there's an increase in all of the different types of ticks.
Yes.
Yeah, but permethrin. Spray those shoes and your pants. Permethrin is your best friend when it comes to prevention.
Here you go.
All right, CAI Sam Houghton. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
A new lab at UMass Dartmouth will study conflicting demands on the ocean and look for ways to resolve them. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with that story. Good morning, Jeanette.
Good morning, Mindy.
So tell us how this came about. They have a new professor who's leading this lab.
Yes. So this is a new lab in the sense of a lab as a research unit, right? Not like a physical space, but it's a new lab, a new research unit led by Assistant Professor Melissa Cronin. She was a new hire in September at the School for Marine Science and Technology. Many listeners may know that's part of UMass Dartmouth, but it's not physically in Dartmouth. It's a pretty big program and it has two buildings down at the tip of the New Bedford Peninsula near the water. And so this new professor, Melissa Cronin, is bringing a new research focus on balancing competing ocean interests. And she's developed that across kind of a few different issue areas. One is manta rays and the conflict with tuna fishing, because manta rays get caught in tuna nets. It's a big problem for their population. Another is the conflict between industrial and small-scale fishing boats, often within the same fishery. She's done some research on ports outside the U.S. where you have like smaller-scale fishing boats who are fishing to feed their own community, but then you also have big industrial scale boats sometimes going after the same species in that area. So there's a conflict there. And then the third area of conflict that's a main one for her lab is a little bit different because part of it is on land, but that is the tension between lobster fishing and essentially the gentrification of coastal land, like making it ways that it's getting harder for people who do lobstering to live and work near the water because of the demand for the land.
Yeah. And you got to visit the lab.
Yes. So I went down to the school and down there at the tip of New Bedford. The School for Marine Science and Technology has big labs with seawater tanks and all of that. But this lab is not that really. This is more of an interdisciplinary lab that incorporates social science. And so her main lab space really looks more like a conference room. It has a refrigerator, a work table, and things like that. And she has, Professor Cronin has samples of manta ray tails that she's using for her research. I got to hold one. But they're small pieces of tails. They're dried out with silica and they're kept in the refrigerator. She says it does not hurt the mantas to collect those tail samples. What happens oftentimes is scientists are going on board tuna boats. And when a manta gets caught, they snip off about 2 inches of the cartilage off the tip of the tail. The DNA is then sequenced at an outside lab, and then she can study things like whether the mantas from different geographic areas are related and how they interbreed, because she said that information is important for conservation management, like knowing where the populations are moving.
How did Cronin get involved in studying this issue of conflict in fisheries?
That is a great question. I was wondering that myself. And she said it developed really from things that she's observed ever since early in her career. And she has an anecdote about this. I would love to play a clip of it in just a minute. That's a clip that did not make it into our story, but let me set the scene for you. So she's in Mexico here. She is helping with a project for her PhD advisor that involves manta rays. She's collecting genetic samples of the manta tails there. But in this area, it's in Baja, the researchers are working with small-scale fishermen to actively, like intentionally capture the mantas to get these tail samples. It's not the same as being on the big boats. And so she is standing on the shore talking to this fisherman. These small-scale fishermen are just using a skiff, you know, to kind of make their own livelihood at the shoreline. And in this story, Melissa Cronin is talking to one of these skiff fishermen and looking out at a very large commercial fishing boat farther out in the water. And she kind of realizes what he's talking about. Let's hear the clip of that.
This fisherman called Felipe, he goes, "Oh, that's a whiskers boat." And I was like, "What is that? What do you mean by that?" Big, you know, big boat just going by this like beautiful picturesque area. And I was like, "What is whiskers?" And I thought, like, it's a Spanish word that I don't know. I've never heard this word. And then he goes like, "Meow, And I was like, oh, he meant cat food, because so much of the tuna catch, and I don't know exact stats, but I can get that for you, but so much of industrial fishing catch is ground up into pet food or meal to feed factory farm animals.
Yeah, so again, this is the idea of industrial fishing fleets with advanced technology and these very large boats competing with small-scale fishers for the same fish. And the idea that, you know, those fishermen who are feeding their families and feeding their communities could get pushed out of that work by industrial fishing.
Can you talk about her work with lobstering? Because that's more local to us.
Yes, sure. Her lobster project is based in Maine in cooperation with a professor at the University of Maine, but it is relevant, of course, to lobster fishers here as well. What they are looking at is the change in where people who hold lobster fishing licenses live over time. The idea is that lobster fishermen seem to be getting pushed farther away from the water because of the demand for vacation homes and real estate in general. And I think that's definitely an issue that resonates with people here, too.
And you talked to a couple lobster fishermen from our area for your story, right?
Yes. Again, these folks are not directly involved in the study, but I wanted to hear some local voices of people who are affected by this idea of displacement from lobstering. One lobster fisher I spoke with was Jeffrey Richardson. He lobsters out of Sandwich Marina, and he said he is considering getting out of it altogether and actually moving to Arizona, in large part because of the property taxes here. He said he pays about $15,000 a year in property taxes on the Cape to live pretty close to the water. I talked with a lobster fisher also who was only 19 years old and fishes out of Menemsha. He was talking not about the taxes, but about access to the waterfront. He says it's gotten more strict. For example, sometimes after a storm, lobster pots wash up on the beach. He says it used to be pretty easy to bring a vehicle out there and pick them up. But now they get in trouble, he says, a lot of times for doing that because private landowners do not want to allow it. He kind of tied that to the idea that very, very wealthy owners are buying up waterfront land. And he also said some places have limits on how long lobster gear can be on the actual fishing dock. He said he has been asked to move his gear off the dock because people don't like looking at it, he says.
All right. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thank you, Jeanette.
All right. Thanks.
Martha's Vineyard schools have a new way to handle cafeteria food scraps. Plans call for all 7 public schools on the island to install rapid food waste recyclers. CAI science and environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes is here to talk about that. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Mindy.
All right. So what is a food waste recycler and how is that different from composting?
Yeah, that was my first question, too, when I started looking into this story. Food waste recyclers are machines that grind up food scraps and heat them up to the point of dehydration, so evaporate all the water. Some of the larger models also integrate sawdust and heat-resistant microbes into the mix. And then what comes out after the machine's 24-hour cycle, it doesn't meet the technical definition of compost, but it is a nutrient-rich product that after a 3-week curing period can be mixed with soil and used to feed school gardens, be spread on school grounds. Sophie Mazza is the community food waste director at Island Grown Initiative, which heads up this project. She told me the machines have built-in odor controls, they're rodent-proof, and they can handle food scraps that you typically keep out of your backyard compost, like meat and dairy.
Can they handle bones and everything?
And Mazza says the machines can deal with chicken bones and the like, but they can't handle large bones and shells. She said they have a tough time with large fruit pits like avocados and peaches. But the project on Martha's Vineyard is really just getting up and running, so I'm sure they'll learn a lot over the next school year. The first recycler was installed at the public charter school, and they've already started using the output to amend school garden soils. They used some of their first batch on a new spiral herb, I'm told. And the machines have also been installed at the regional high school and at Chilmark School. The Chilmark School is a much smaller school, so theirs is actually an indoor model. But the other two are installed on concrete pads outside, and those will have wooden structures built around them so they can have a roof over them.
And you reported that the recyclers will also be installed at some trash drop-offs and transfer stations around the vineyard. How's that going to work?
Yeah, that's right. The idea is people can bring a bucket of food scraps with them to the trash drop-off, and the compost-like output will be free for them to take home and use on their own garden, so they could fill that same bucket right back up. How it's going to work.
And are the towns paying for that?
Mazza says the school units have so far been primarily funded through private donations, with some money coming in from the towns. The towns are able to apply for recycling dividend program funds through MassDEP, and that money has been put towards the site work, like those wooden structures that I talked about and the concrete pads. And she said this past town meeting, four of the six towns on the vineyard approved funds to purchase recyclers for residential use at those drop-offs. Edgartown's looking into grant funding, and Tisbury voters decided to hold off a year and weigh their options.
All right. CAI Science and Environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks, Mindy.
Coming up, Nantucket scallops fleet faces an uncertain future, and feds cut Global Ocean Observing Network. Stay with us. And you're listening to the Friday News Roundup on The Point. What will become of Nantucket's scallop fleet? Josh Balling from the Enquirer and Mirror joins us with that story. Hey, Josh.
Good morning.
So uncertainty about the future isn't for the lack of scallops, right? It's fewer commercial scallop fishermen?
That's exactly what it is. The Nantucket scallop fishery itself has made something of a comeback in the last decade or so after some serious concerns about water quality and declining eelgrass that support the Nantucket Bay scallop. A lot of efforts were made both to improve the quality of the harbor waters on Nantucket and to reseed the eelgrass beds with shellfish, and it's really working. But now there are fewer commercial scallopers than ever, especially younger ones who are out there combing those eelgrass beds each winter for Nantucket Bays. And it's providing a little bit of some concerns and a harbinger of wonder about what's going to happen moving forward. We have a fishery, probably the last viable commercial bay scallop fishery on the East Coast and maybe in the country, that regularly produced more than 50,000 bushels a season. Now it's rare when we even get over 10,000 bushels, and that's largely due to a lack of fishermen.
Yeah, and you mentioned that some of the younger fishermen are not wanting to be scallop fishermen. What are the barriers? Is it cost?
There's a couple of barriers, really. One is that the island economy is better in general. Scalloping, it sounds like a pretty good deal. You go out on the water in the morning, and you're generally home by early afternoon, but you're also doing it from November through April, and some of those months are really hard. And now there are contracting jobs and work in the trades where you can pound nails inside or at least on dry land, not be out there when it's blowing really hard and snowing. And you can make a lot more money when you can make $50 an hour, hammering nails as opposed to trying your luck and hoping that you'll catch your limit of scallops and then hoping that the price will be high enough to make it worth your while. It's a tough go. Yeah. And also the cost of getting in is a little bit higher now, too. You need a boat. You need the equipment. Yeah. And there are lack of shanties to open scallops, to process them. And the prices have been coming down a little bit as well. They're not making, not fetching quite as much as they used to.
Yeah. So are there any efforts afoot to encourage younger people to take up commercial scalloping? I know some of the scallopers we have are getting close to retirement. So
that's exactly it. The fleet itself is aging out to some degree and not being replaced at the same same pace as it used to be. And those scallopers themselves are concerned. The town's shellfish and natural resources officials are concerned. And the Nantucket Shellfish Association is concerned. And there's a lot of talk right now. No real programs have been implemented yet, but there's discussion of loan programs that would allow scallopers, young scallopers, to get into the industry. No interest loans to maybe buy boats and equipment. There's talk of revamping the scallop internship program so that it'd be easier to get your license faster. And the big discussion right now, and sort of on the heels of the creation of the deer processing facility to help with food insecurity on the island, and the Hive, which is a food services incubator in the middle of the island, to create maybe a centralized scallop processing and opening place where scallopers can go and not either be tied into a specific fish market or definitely have a place to open scallops and get them out onto the market on their own. And all that stuff sort of in the early stages now, but it's definitely being talked about. And we'll see what happens. There was about 10,000 bushels harvested this year, a little bit less than that. So it's about on par with the last few years. But there's still, according to town shellfish officials, a lot of scallops on the you know, on the floor of the harbor that are probably going to die. They don't last more than a year or so. Yeah. So it's, you know, they have a short lifespan, and if they're not harvested, they're just going to, you know, they're not going to be there anymore.
So sad. All right. And we've got a busy weekend with the book festival underway, and then the film festival follows next week.
Right on its heels. The Nantucket Book Festival is right in the middle of its 4 days of events, author talks, discussions, social events. It's now in its 15th year. It opened with a preview event on Wednesday, runs through Sunday. All the events, except for one, are free and held within walking distance of downtown. There's an author dinner tonight. It's the only ticketed event, and that raises money for the Nantucket Book Foundation, which sponsors the festival, runs literacy programs and author events year-round, including a very popular Authors in School series where, you know, published authors come into the schools, the elementary school, the middle school, and the high school, and work with educators and talk to students about, you know, sort of the power of books and the importance of literacy. And that, you know, that runs through Sunday. And then almost right away, the Nantucket Film Festival comes to town. Next Wednesday through Sunday, they've got more than 50 narrative and documentary films. They open with The Invite, starring Olivia Wilde. And then they wrap up with The Five Star Weekend, a screening of some of the episodes of The Five Star Weekend based on Island author Ellen Hildebrand's book of the same name that filmed out here on Nantucket last year.
All right. Josh Bolling from the Enquirer Mirror. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Mitty.
A historic home in West Harwich that has been long neglected will be restored. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So this is the former Bishop's Terrace property that includes one of the oldest homes in town, right?
Yeah, it's one of the oldest homes specifically in this neighborhood. This area between the Herring River and the Dennistown line along Route 28 is known as Captain's Row. If anybody's driven down there, it's got a quite a few old captain's houses that are really beautiful. This former Bishop's Terrace restaurant, the centerpiece of it is the Job Chase House, which was built in 1778 as one of the first homes along this stretch. And you're right, Mindy, for many years, this the Bishop's Terrace restaurant closed over a decade ago, and the actually probably 20 or 30 years ago, and the property has been vacant since then, and it's really been neglected, and it was recently condemned by the town because of the condition of it. But now we have a new buyer has a purchase and sales agreement, which is actually supposed to close today, this is a couple of local folks who plan to rehab the Chase House and return it to its original condition, and hopefully, which will vastly contribute to the Captain's Row area as far as making it more cohesive and more beautiful, really.
Yeah, what a labor of love, huh? A lot of work involved in bringing that back to its glory.
Sure, it's going to take a lot of work. They're going to be removing a lot of sort of attached structures that were added over the years, which are not really historically significant, and just concentrating on the Chase House, which they hope will to start going through various town agencies to get permissions to do that work. And so far, there's been a lot of positive feedback in the town about this.
And then over in Brewster, the Chamber of Commerce still looking for a new home.
Yeah, as I think we talked about before, the Chamber of Commerce was asked to leave the town offices building in Brewster, where they had been located for many years. The town officials said they just needed the office space for different departments that were sort of homeless at that point. And so the chamber moved out. They have been given sort of temporary quarters in an office building on Underpass Road, where they are able to conduct business, but there's no public facing facility there. So this is going to be the first summer where they haven't had a visitor's center for the public to go to drop in and get information about the town. The chamber has set up a kiosk at the Lemon Tree Village where they're going to be posting information about things going on around town. But they're in the mode of trying to find a permanent location, hopefully for both their offices and a visitor's center. If those have to be two different spots, then the chamber folks say that they'll deal with that, but they'd like to find one place, and they're still looking. Mm-hmm. Anyone who has information or a building that they think might be suitable can contact the chamber, and they'd be very happy to hear from you.
All right, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Mindy.
As the federal government announces plans to dismantle a deep-sea network that collects data for scientists to monitor and catalog everything from ocean temperature to acidity to oxygen content to currents, two Menemsha fishermen say they're going to help collect bottom water temperature. Haley Duffy from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us. Hi, Haley.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
Good. So first, let's talk about what's being cut.
Yeah, so it actually came out at the beginning. It was told to HUI that this program was going to be cut at the beginning of May, but it really just hit the newsstands recently that this Ocean Observatories Initiative, which is mostly run out of HUI in Woods Hole, they're dismantling over 900 instruments that are around the world that collect all of this like deep sea data that is then publicly used and used by researchers to, understand that marine environment more.
Yeah. So tell us about the two fishermen and what they're planning.
Yeah. So this is completely separate from the federal program, but it kind of is happening around the same time that this is being dismantled. So these two Menemsha fishermen are joining the EMOLT program, which is maintained by NOAA Fisheries, but it is actually administered by the Gulf of Maine Lobster Foundation. And they are able to give this new technology that's, uses Bluetooth and these sensors to track bottom water data that's then given straight to the fishermen and then sent back to the researchers through Bluetooth. And they're joining a cohort of close now to 200 vessels that are doing this, and they're able to get a lot of geographically distributed data of bottom water temperatures through them.
Oh, that's great. So maybe that'll help me fill the gap of what's being cut, right? Yeah. All right, another story. You have an Edgartown property hits the global market for a record asking price of $49 mm-hmm. million. Dollars.
Right. Yeah, so if this sells at $49 million, it would set the record for the vineyard, which was previously held at $37.9 million with the property sold in November. And on the market also in Chilmark, there's a $45 million home being sold. So, the vineyard market is definitely trending up.
All right. Haley Duffy from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Haley.
Thank you, Mindy.
Low student enrollment likely to impact the Wellfleet Elementary School. Tyler Jager from the Provincetown Independent joins us with that story. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
Good. So this is one of several proposals that would have Wellfleet merging with another elementary school sometime in this next decade.
That's right. This was a study of regionalization and efficiency. It funded by a state grant It involved four major proposals, and in three of them, Wellfleet Elementary School would be merged with a school either in Orleans with the Eastham Elementary School or with a different kind of configuration in the Nauset School District among its elementary schools.
So this doesn't come as welcome news to those in Wellfleet, right? They don't want to. Nobody wants to see their local school close. So how much say does the town have about its future for the school?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was certainly the reception of the study was certainly that many residents, as well as, the select board and the school committee, were sort of sending a joint message that they were opposed to any sort of solution to low enrollment that would involve consolidating the school into a school that would no longer be in Wellfleet. It's true that I think that the town administrator said at these meetings, town meeting has to make a decision about whether the school continues in its current configuration, whether it would merge or do something differently. There are methods by which, for instance, Truro and Provincetown aren't in the Nauset School District. They're independent elementary schools. They're accredited with the state. So there was some floating of ideas at that at this meeting where this study was presented by a few school committee members, whether Wellfleet could do a similar take a similar step in that direction.
So still lots of conversation to be had before anything is decided, right?
Right, right. So the study didn't make any recommendations, but it is putting on the table something that has been a topic of discussion in Wellfleet for a really long time.
Yeah. All right, Tyler Jager from the Provincetown Independent. Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you, Mindy. Take care.
Coming up, the latest from the State House. Stay with us. You're listening to the Friday News Roundup. The governor extends last call for bars and voices her support for happy hour. The State House wants to prevent book bans, and the State Senate weighs a bill that aims to make it easier to get a doctor's appointment. CAI's Gilda Geis checks in with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon.
Governor Maura Healey has been publicly supportive of two measures that loosen alcohol laws in Massachusetts. So let's start with last call. What is the governor doing to extend the time that bars can stay open?
Yeah, so in light of the World Cup matches and associated celebrations coming up here in Massachusetts, the governor signed a bill this week that will let bars stay open in certain cases an hour later than they usually would, so up to 3 a.m. And that legislation would also let cities and towns that want to do so create public districts where people can drink alcohol, maybe on the street or in a park, as long as they buy it from an approved vendor, something like the situation more in New Orleans than we're used to here in Massachusetts. And none of this is automatic. If bars want to stay open later, they'll have to get permission from their city or town. Nothing is going to be required to stay open till 3 a.m., but this is something that folks on Beacon Hill feel will help Massachusetts compete with the other bigger cities like New York, LA, that are hosting World Cup matches and known for better nightlife scenes, more vibrant late night activities, and be appealing to international visitors who are used to staying out until the early morning hours.
And the governor has also recently voiced her support for bringing happy hour back to Massachusetts. What is her reasoning for that? Is it the same? Does it have to do with the World Cup?
This is something more focused on people who are in Massachusetts year round. This is, according to the governor, something that could help young people, I think the 18 to 35 age range, stay in Boston, stay in Massachusetts broadly as when they have spaces to hang out and socialize. That's what she said on WEEI this week. But, you know, of course, that's one piece of the puzzle. Young people need to be able to afford housing, need to be able to find jobs. Those are the bigger policy pieces. She thinks this could be another addition there. It's not really clear if this is something that would be able to get through the legislature. The Senate has tried a couple times to reverse the state's 1984 ban on happy hours, but the House hasn't been willing to go along with it, in part because some restaurants don't think it's a good idea.
The State House passed a bill recently to prevent the censorship of certain books. So what were lawmakers' concerns, and how does the bill attempt to address those concerns?
So this is something that the legislature has been looking at as a way to prohibit politically motivated attempts at banning books, particularly from school libraries. It declares that students have a right to receive information from school library materials that are educational and age appropriate. And it would require districts to develop written policies around the selection of library materials. This is something the State Senate has already passed a version of. So once lawmakers in the two chambers work out their differences, it could find its way to Governor Healey's desk.
And the State Senate is looking at a bill that aims to do what may sound impossible, making it easier to find a primary care provider in Massachusetts. How would that work?
Yeah, anyone who's tried to book a doctor's appointment, particularly as a new patient, knows that there is a shortage of providers. And what the Senate wants to do here is set a target for how much of the state's total healthcare spending has to go to primary care. This is something former Governor Charlie Baker also proposed doing. It's a way to make sure that there is enough investment in primary care as opposed to other areas of healthcare to encourage doctors to work in that field, which is really the basics of healthcare, and make sure that there's enough support so that patients can access the care when they need it. Now, overall, the goal here is to ensure that even if we're spending more pieces of the pie on primary care, the pie as a whole isn't growing so that healthcare does not become more expensive. It's going to be pretty complex to work out the full details there.
That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Yarmouth Port resident David Bermudez is the oldest living veteran of the Stonewall Rebellion of June 28, 1969, when gay and lesbian patrons of the Stonewall Inn fought back against a police raid at the New York City gay bar. David and his husband Robert Isidore are the grand marshals for the second ever Lower Cape Pride Parade this coming Saturday. CAI's Gilda Geis spoke with David and Robert to learn more.
David, what do you remember from that night at Stonewall?
I lived in Manhattan after a divorce, and while I was in New York City, I got to meet people and all, and I still wasn't out. There's a park that we used to always sit at and lay down to get sun and all that, the guys and all that, you know. And we used to have a little radio, and while we were sitting there, we heard that Judy Garland passed on. And we were like shocked because Judy was a very good friend to all the gay people. And my friend said, hey, Dave, let's go to the village and let's celebrate her life. I said, all right. So we got on the subway and we hit all the bars. We were across the street from the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village. And my friend said, come on, let's go to the Stonewall. Let's have a drink. So I said, okay. So we went in, we ordered our drinks, and in the bars, there was always a little red light that would go on that there's a cop in here or something like that. Split. Don't touch each other. Don't kiss. You know what I mean? We saw that. We went, holy, what's going on? So we split. And then all of a sudden, a big bright light goes on. There was a bright, bright white light that used to go on that the cops are coming in. They're going to raid us.
This was even in the 60s in New York City. It was illegal to serve gay people alcoholic beverages.
In bars. Bars were raided all the time, even lesbian bars and all, you know. But this time, a lady cop uniform with a man, and then two plain clothes, they call those. And while they came through, they were calling us fags and, you know what I mean, queers and all that stuff, which was horrible. And the four of us there going, oh my God, we're going to get arrested or we're going to get beat up or whatever, you know. It just came crazy and we wanted to get out. So when I was getting out of the bar, I saw a young man who had a billy club and I saw him choking this kid and I went to jump and my friends were pulling me out because I thought they were going to kill the kid. I couldn't get him off. You know, it was such a big riot going on. At the end of it all, the kid that they were going to murder or whatever, he turned out to be the head of the Stonewall Association in New York City. Bob and I met him. We were shocked because for years I was wondering if this boy was killed.
And then a year later was the first ever Pride Parade, and you were there for that as well. Can you tell me about it?
In 1970, at the anniversary of Stonewall, we all got together and said, we can't let this go. We have to march. It was like, I think, 10 of us. By the time that parade got to Central Park, there was thousands. Remember, at that time, women's rights, that was big. Vietnam was very, very big. The Black movement, right? Very big. And who comes in? Us gays. We're the next one. I'm the oldest Stonewall veteran alive today. A lot of the guys, I want you to know, died of AIDS. A lot of the guys that were at Stonewall.
So you guys are both pretty politically active here on the Cape. Robert, can you tell us more about what that looks like?
David has, since we've been here, he's done a lot of speaking engagements. We both do some together. We do local schools and churches. It's his thing with the speeches. My thing was on a different channel. I, at one time, was the chairman of the board of directors at the Yarmouth COA. We started a pilot program where we publicly opened the center and welcomed the LGBT community, the seniors. We did workshops with the police, the fire department, all the emergency services to come in and listen to our concerns. Had attorneys come in and listen and talk about what we could do to protect ourselves. But I think the most rewarding thing for me was that we established the first hospice program for gay people on the Cape and the first bereavement group. It must have been 22 years ago, and both are still running.
That's David Bermudez and Robert Isidore, Grand Marshals of the Lower Cape Pride Parade this Saturday at 10 a.m. David and Robert, thank you both so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Gilda, for your time. Anytime
you want to do something, call us.
For CAI, I'm Gilda Geist.
And the Lower Cape Pride kicks off today with the parade coming tomorrow. For more information and to hear an extended version of this interview, head over to our website, capeandislands.org. All right, the World Cup is coming to Massachusetts, as you know. This is more than a soccer tournament, but the premier sporting event of the world. And while tickets might be unreasonable for the fair weather fan, there are still ways to take in the excitement. Ahead of game one in Foxborough tomorrow between Scotland and Haiti, CAI's Sam Houghton spoke with our sports correspondent, Esteban Bastillos.
I've never witnessed this before, but I've heard, you know, the experiences surrounding the World Cup are something really to behold, with fans coming from all over the globe. And not just inside the stadium, but on the streets and watching in local bars as well. Tell us how someone, you know, maybe from Cape looking to get up there, how they might experience this.
Yeah. First, I would say, unless you have a ticket, you should probably avoid Foxborough on match days. It's going to be very, very busy. I think this week is sort of when it's felt like, oh, this is actually happening now, right? Because it's been such a long buildup, but, you know, I was driving down near Gillette last week and it looks very different. There's no sign that says Gillette Stadium anywhere that's been covered up. There's big signs for, like, you know, Boston 26, We Are Boston. So it looks very much more like this is a World Cup stadium. This is happening now. What started Thursday, they had the Fan Fest near City Hall Plaza in Boston, where folks can gather. And I think even just beyond that, you know, you go to bars where they have flags of all these different countries that are coming through. It is here. It does feel like it's real. And now all we have to see is, like, will this work? Because I think that's still a little bit of a question mark. But yeah.
Well, let's get into that. I mean, I saw one estimate of something like 500,000 people coming into Boston, Foxborough for this. I can imagine that's obviously a logistics nightmare, but the governor this week calmed some folks or tried to, saying they, you know, the state is prepared. What is the message from the governor here and security officials going into the weekend?
Yeah, I think, like you said, Sam, the governor was calling Massachusetts match ready, right? That was sort of the message earlier this week on Monday. I think the real message that I sort of took away was actually from Philip Eng with the MBTA, basically being like, look, commuter rail tickets for these matches are like one of the hottest ticket items out there right now. You know, beyond that, yeah, I mean, there is a lot of security in place. Even driving around Foxborough last week, there are so many parking spots at the actual stadium that are no longer there just because they have security checkpoints and security parameters in place. And so it's going to be a lot of a different experience than if you were going to a Patriots game or a concert or even a New England Revolution game. This is going to be much different than that because it is such a huge global event.
All right, well, let's get to the, you know, the game here, the pitch. I've heard Team USA has zero chance of winning the cup. I've heard their star Christian Pulisic is in kind of an epic scoring drought in his European league. You know, what are some of the Cinderella stories you might be following, and who might be, you know, a favorite to take all the glory here?
Yeah, I think, you know, to get to Team USA, it's famously they missed the World Cup in 2018, and now, you know, so this is a long arc of maybe possible redemption. I don't know if a lot of folks are favoring them. I think it's just going to be just in general very thrilling, very exciting just to see them on home soil.
Totally.
And, you know, I was talking to American fans who are like, who are going to some of those games, paying a lot of money, and there's just sort of this disbelief that they're going to watch the U.S. in a World Cup and the United States. And that means a lot, regardless of how the Americans fare on the pitch. As you said, though, some very tough competition. Obviously, France, who's going to be based here locally in Boston, they're huge favorites. Obviously, Kylian Mbappe, one of the best players in the world. Spain is going to be very strong, of course. Some of the underdog stories, though, and this is part of what makes the World Cup fun and great, is that there's so many different stories and teams coming from around the world, even if they never make it past the group stage. You know, here for this first match, Haiti-Scotland, Haiti hasn't played in the World Cup since 1974, and that was the only other time that they played in the World Cup, and they've never won a World Cup match. Obviously, there's a huge Haitian population here in Massachusetts in the Boston area, so this is a very exciting time for them, especially because one of the players for Haiti, Franzi Pierrot, actually, you know, grew up here in Massachusetts, played at Melrose High School, so he's become sort of a local hero. And then, you know, a team that isn't playing here locally but has gotten a lot of attention, Cape Verde. This is their first time playing in the World Cup. A lot of Cape Verdeans in the area, they're super excited. Unfortunately, their first game is against Spain on Monday. So that's a tall hill to climb for their first ever World Cup match.
We'll see, though. I mean, that's, you know, that is Esteban Bustillos, our sports reporter. Esteban, thanks so much for joining us.
Sam, thank you.
And that's going to wrap up this week's News Roundup. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.